Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks, and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together.
I have a question for you. Is Christmas music, by the way, this is Matt Tebbe.
Hey, and Ben Sternke, Gravity Leadership. Yep, you got it.
Yada, yada. Is Christmas music a big deal in your house?
Sort of. It's not a huge deal.
You would know. You would know if it is.
It's not a big deal. My wife does like to listen to Christmas music. It's kind of a carefully curated Christmas music. It's not just anything.
Yeah, you don't have time for that.
Yeah.
Only jabronis have time for that.
Yeah.
And jamokes. Yep. What does jamoke mean? Is that offensive?
I don't even know what jabroni
means. Did I just
say
something offensive?
I hope not.
That would be only the 13th time this morning.
Yeah, whoops. If that offends you, just email Matt at gravityleadership.com and let him know what a jabok is.
You're only starting to get to know me when I start when I've pushed you away.
Yeah, yes. Three times.
Christmas music. What does she listen to? Do you feel comfortable?
For a while, we listened to
a violation
of
confidence?
No, I don't think so. Sufjan Stevens, we used to listen to a lot of his album.
Yeah.
We got a little tired of that one a few years ago because we overdid it a bit.
Yeah.
You know,
it's played out.
Even though it's great music and love the guy, but you know, we just got a little tired of it. So it's a lot of that kind of thing. I think, I can't remember. There's a couple other Christmas albums that I really appreciate.
I grew up listening to Christmas music. My mom was playing it nonstop from like basically Labor Day on.
It's almost Christmas.
As soon as we turned the air conditioning off, Christmas music went on.
Uh-huh.
And so I grew up with Harry Belafonte.
Oh wow,
he's got a Christmas album.
This is older than Sufjan Stevens.
I grew up with the Muppets and John Denver Christmas album.
Oh yeah,
I grew up with
my parents love John Denver.
Yeah. My parents love John Denver too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I grew up listening to the Carpenters Family Christmas album.
Oh, yeah.
That may be my favorite.
My mom loved the Carpenters.
It's a solid.
Yeah.
Solid
album.
Every time Karen Carpenter sings, an angel gets his wings. That lady.
Yes.
I remember being in grade school or middle school, and we watched a Karen Carpenter story on TV.
Yeah.
It was basically about her eating disorder and how she died of anorexia.
I don't know any of this.
Yeah,
wow.
She had anorexia and died. And I remember thinking... As I was probably 10, 11, 12, watching this in school thinking, I'm too young to watch this. I should not be watching this.
This is aren't there adults serious in charge life here? Issues yeah. going on right here.
Yeah. So, and we I also grew up listening to, my mom was into New Age music, which some of you, that may trigger you. I know. But New Age music doesn't have anything to do with necessarily pagan religion.
Right.
It was just a genre of music.
I don't know if you're saying it right, but yeah.
Isn't it? It's a French word, right?
Jean. Yeah.
Jean.
Yeah. There's no syllables.
John.
Every French word is one
genre
syllable.
Genre is like saying gyro.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Right.
Yeah. I think so.
Okay. Well, anyway, for the Americans listening, the similar genre of New Age. I don't know what a jamoke means. Don't say it again.
I was saying the wrong thing.
What?
I said jaboke.
No. Jabroni means a foolish or contemptuous person.
Okay.
What was I thinking of? Jamoke. Jamoke.
We keep saying it. I'm afraid it's offensive.
The J word? I don't know what it means.
I was thinking Jabberwocky. That's something
different. That's different too.
That's Alice in Wonderland.
Anyway, the New Age album was A Winter Solstice. It was like this instrumental.
Oh, I know that. I used to listen to that all the time. What's the guy's name?
Windham Hill?
Gary? Windham Hill Records.
Yeah.
Gary? Greg?
George? I don't know.
George!
George Winston.
There it is.
Yeah, Winston. Hill. He also had an album called December. Anyway, so all this music, it's the only reason I haven't deleted iTunes off my laptop
and
just streamed everything through Spotify because I have all these albums from my childhood downloaded here, and it would just take me a lot of time to curate that playlist somewhere
else. Yeah, sure.
So I actually have an external hard drive and a 500 gig flash drive on my laptop, mostly...
with Christmas music.
Mostly to ferry my Christmas music along my journey with me from my childhood. So maybe your Christmas music is in full swing, which it's legal, speaking as Anglicans.
That's okay.
Harmon likes that when we speak as Anglicans.
Yeah,
no, it's that we're officially in the liturgical season of Advent.
Yes.
And you can...
start it on Sunday.
You can listen to... Now, honestly, can I get a little nerdy?
Sure.
There's a difference between Advent music and Christmas music.
Yes, there is. A huge difference.
Yeah, and we don't really delineate between those two things in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Jingle Bell Rock, neither.
Neither. No. Yeah, who knows what that's about?
Jingle Bells, neither.
Yeah, yeah.
No, there's like cultural Christmas music, but then there's like O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, which is an Advent song.
That's an Advent song, right.
Yeah, it's a longing. So
Advent's a season of longing. It's a season of awaiting the coming of Christ. And actually, the church for a long time has... coupled it with, right now, we don't long for Christ's first advent, we long for his second advent, we long for his second coming. So Advent's actually a season where we talk about and think about and long for the second coming of Christ.
It's when I read through all the Left Behind books again,
every Advent,
as a discipline.
Well, actually, the first Sunday, if you're not familiar, if you didn't go to a liturgical church on Sunday, the first Sunday of Advent, like the readings are a little shocking.
Yeah, they're
because it's Jesus talking about the destruction of the temple and how the church has sort of taken some of those scenes and said, like, you know, these are scenes that we meditate on as we think about the end of all things. And so if you're coming in expecting, you know, little Jesus in a manger, the first Sunday of Advent can be a little shocking.
Jarring.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's Christmas songs that are like, Joy to the World, the Lord has come. Mm-hmm. Right, that would be a
the
Christmas.
The Lord has come, right?
That'd
it's past
be a Christmas
tense.
Song. Right. Yeah. Anyway, that is probably way more nerdy than you wanted.
If you want a good album for Advent,
I'll just say this. How did you know I did?
If you want specifically Advent music, I would recommend. We'll put a link in the show notes. Liturgical Folk, our friend Ryan Flanagan,
shout out,
has a great Advent album. It's specifically Advent music that he wrote for. It's around some specific prayers that we pray. For the four Sundays of Advent, and it's great, and it ends with this, you know, the Nativity. It ends with the birth of Christ. It's a beautiful album. I really, really like it.
Does he cover? Is that the album he covers? Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Yep, that one and Jingle Bells, I think.
By the way, before we got to get into this,
we do.
But John Legend, re-recorded Baby, It's Cold Outside, and took out all the creepy, rapey lyrics.
Oh, really?
He rewrote it.
Oh, wow.
With a woman.
That's impressive, because there's...
She's like, I really can't stay. He's like, you have agency over your body. She's like, I gotta go away. Far be it from me to say no. You know?
That's amazing.
She's like, it's this evening has been. Yeah. You really should maybe turn in. You know? It's not as cheesy as that. But,
right, right.
But it's not coercive...
It's not creepy and coercive.
Here's what's fascinating to me. So we just rewatched Elf recently. We have these, again, I'm using this in a cultural way, Christmas movies that our kids like. And Elf is one of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a scene where Will Ferrell as Elf is sitting in a shower,
right?
And Jovi is what's her name? What's the singer's name?
Zooey Deschanel.
She's singing that song, and he's singing the other part, and it's like cute because like the elf doesn't know that he's not supposed to be in a bathroom with a woman, even though that would seem. That would seem like something that would translate from an elf culture. I've never met an elf, but that would seem. Anyway, but even that was that movie came out 18 years ago.
That's amazing.
But 18 years ago, that song was like delightful,
super
and heartwarming,
cute.
And cute. And everybody had these, you know, warm jingle bell tinglies happening when they heard it. And now you listen to that song and you're like,
there's new eyes. After Me Too.
It's crazy how fast culture is shifting right now.
Yeah.
It's just crazy to me.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's what we do at Gravity. We're trying to help each other inhabit a faith that will endure, that's agile, not fragile, that is adaptable, not sort of static.
Yeah.
And and if one thing happens, for instance, if it's no longer okay to date rape women, which
sing about it,
like your faith, you don't have to lose everything.
Yeah.
And so, friends, thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for signing up and joining our email list. It's free.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't yet considered or done so, please consider signing up and supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/gravityleadership. We're doing this.
Yep.
And we'd love for you to do it with us.
Yeah. It's a great way to be involved. Also, we're going to get into this interview here with Chuck DeGroat. We're going to talk about the Enneagram and narcissism. He's got some really insightful things to say.
This guy.
Yeah.
I love this guy.
Oh, yeah. And we got to actually go into his office. We were up in Michigan, and we got to go hang out in his office at the seminary there. And I really liked his office.
I did too. His books were amazing.
Books.
Can I tell you like a quick anecdote? This is about my dad, actually.
Okay.
My dad did all, like, you know, dad jokes are like dad. Like dad. My dad always would say words that were like PG-13, like butt and poop jokes.
Nice.
So we had this. So anyway, anytime he said office growing up, he'd say orifice.
Orifice.
And every time somebody says office, I just think orifice, which isn't. Have anything to do with Chuck DeGroat. Not that he's against orifices.
Yeah,
but we were in his office.
Yeah, we were in his office. It was a great conversation.
Just to be clear, Chuck has no position on orifices at all. That was me I was putting something in. I don't want to put words in Chuck's mouth. We were in Chuck's office talking about the Enneagram. We should probably just get to that.
Yeah. The reason we're doing this series.
Why?
Is that we do Enneagram workshops. And so if you're interested in bringing us into your city, your church, your region, check it out at gravityleadership.com/Enneagram. And we've also got links to all the places we're going to be. We're going to be in Indianapolis in January. We're going to be in Michigan a couple times in March and April, a couple other places so far. So anyway, check it out. And if you want to support us on our membership community, that's patreon.com/Gravity Leadership. We are thankful that you guys are part of this community, and let's get to this interview.
Advent.
Yep, it's Advent, and here's Chuck DeGroat on the Enneagram and narcissism. Chuck, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, it's really good to have you.
On location, in Chuck's office.
Yeah, we're in Chuck's office. We're smelling a lovely candle.
And I'm distracted, aesthetically.
Why is that?
Well, you've got about 73 books in here, Chuck, that I've identified that I haven't read, that I really want to read.
Yeah.
And then there's like another 43 books, like The Critical Journey by Hagberg.
Mm. Oh, that's a good one.
Or these Laird books here that changed my life.
Yes. Mm.
That I just want to talk to you about. Like, so few people have read. I mean, The Critical Journey, that was a seminal book for me.
Yeah, it's so important.
It named so many things I couldn't name. And I was like, this changes everything.
Yeah.
But it's like this little little teeny tiny book.
Yeah.
You know?
Who knows about it?
Nobody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Laird books have been, I'm rereading Into the Silent Land now and reading it much slower so I actually practice what he's talking about rather than just ripping through it.
Right. Yeah. Just having the pleasure of knowing this idea.
Anyway,
ADD. Yeah. Like, yeah. I have ADD, and the visual stimulation of this room is almost more than I can take.
Mm. Yeah. You have to do the whole podcast with your eyes
closed. I'm going to have to close my eyes. My glasses are off.
Just breathe. Just breathe, Matt. It's going to be okay.
There we go.
Yeah.
We go.
I haven't read any of these books anyway. I just keep them around.
Just to impress people who come into your office.
I need to feel special. I'm a four.
Oh, hey, another Enneagram four. Speaking of the Enneagram.
I think I understand that.
Yes. So, folks, we are in the middle of this mini-series on the Enneagram, and we wanted to talk with Chuck today because Chuck knows a thing or two about the Enneagram. And if you have listened to our podcast for a while, you know that Chuck also has been on our podcast before, so welcome back.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Chuck knows a thing or two about narcissism. And
what's that supposed to mean?
Well,
there's only a few experts on narcissism, Chuck is definitely one of them.
Takes one to know one.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
Just joking. No, but that's what you talked about with us last time.
Yeah.
Talked about narcissism in leadership, and I think you just threw out right at the end of that podcast that you had done some work on the nine faces of narcissism and how narcissism shows up in each of the Enneagram types.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I'm filing that idea away for later. And here we are. We're going to talk about the nine faces of narcissism through the lens of the Enneagram. And maybe it'd be good to just to preface this by saying, like our first podcast about the Enneagram, we talked about how it's been helpful for our own formation.
Mm.
And so what, I don't know, maybe you can answer this, Chuck.
How did you encounter it?
What, the Enneagram?
Yeah, Chuck. Yeah. Like, how did you encounter it, and why was it so appealing to you?
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, it was back in the late 90s. I was in a counseling program back then, and one of my supervisors was using a book called Radical Grace by Richard Rohr. And we would read one of those devotions or meditations every time we were together, and so I did a little bit of research about this Richard Rohr and discovered his Enneagram book and devoured it.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the first read. And, you know, I mean, the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, there are so many books out, but I could not find very many resources back there about the Enneagram. I found some things here or there. And maybe every 2 years or something, found a little book, picked it up, read it. I have not done any kind of formal training, but I've just read and worked with people and had many, many, many conversations and work groups and triad groups and all sorts of other contexts where I've used the Enneagram. So,
Okay. It's really similar for me. Yeah. Like I've never been trained formally in it, but have just been fascinated with it and interested in it. And not just academically, but very quickly it was helpful for my own formation. And very quickly it was helpful for my ministry as well, where I began to help. It was easier to help people kind of understand, you know, their underlying motivations kind of reveal some of that stuff. So it's great.
Yeah.
So, as we talk about then the intersection of the Enneagram with narcissism, like what, I'd love to just ask, like what, as people get ready to kind of hear about this, how can this become for us not just sort of an interesting academic kind of exercise, but like what should we be thinking about as we listen for these nine ways that narcissism shows up in our lives?
Yeah, so as I got into the narcissism conversation for the book, I mean, I've been doing work with folks in clinical counseling for 20 plus years now and encountered narcissism in all kinds of different contexts. But as I was getting into more of the like formal research for the book, I was noticing that in a number of the works that I was consulting and reading, there would be like labels for different kinds of narcissists, right?
Okay.
That really matched my experience. Like sometimes we've got this kind of typical sense of what a narcissist is, very grandiose and arrogant and overconfident, things like that.
Yeah.
But it got me thinking, I wonder if the Enneagram might be helpful. I wonder if the Enneagram describes particular kinds of energies that can manifest in narcissistic kinds of ways. And one of the big distinctions when we talk about narcissism is grandiose narcissism versus what they call vulnerable narcissism. Some people call it covert narcissism. But grandiose narcissism being the person who wants to be on stage and is more grandiose, inspiring,
kind of overtly arrogant.
Overtly arrogant.
Yeah, yeah.
But vulnerable narcissism shows up in a much different way, a bit more passive-aggressive, a kind of smug superiority, someone who plays the victim, high emotionality, somewhat dramatic, behind the scenes, but you feel the tug. So I began working this through the lens of the Enneagram and just rolled with it.
Yeah.
So this is based on my own, you know, my own work with people over the last 20 years as a pastor and a therapist and a spiritual director.
Hmm.
It's suggestive. I kind of say, hey, this chapter I'm putting out there and I'd love people to interrogate it, but here it is. Here are some thoughts.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So this is a series on the Enneagram, but would you give us a brief, like, simple synopsis of what you're referring to when you describe narcissism?
Right.
That word has a lot of cultural purchase in our world.
Mm-hmm.
But and so one of the problems is we use it so much that we no longer know what it means.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's a jerk is a narcissist. So what are you referring to when you describe a narcissist?
Well, it's tough because there is some nuancing. So there's the DSM-5, you know, the psychiatric Bible. There's the DSM-5 diagnosis that talks about things like grandiosity, a lack of empathy, identity impairments, features like that. But I think when we talk about narcissism more in a more nuanced way, that's where the Enneagram types can help.
Mm.
I do think, you know, in general, when we talk about personality disorders, it's kind of like the armor that we wear in the world. Personality disorders like narcissistic personality, histrionic, avoidant, are ways that we learned very early on to cope in a broken world.
Okay.
We all have some armor that we wear. We talk about the masks that we wear, the personas, things like that. But with a personality disorder, it has become fixed. It's almost like it's become the primary identity. And it really protects a hurting, vulnerable person inside, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so narcissism then is the fixation or the fetishing of focusing on me and getting, like, protecting me, getting my needs met, like the self-absorption.
I think you're right in that. Like, it's a way of getting needs met, right? And so there's this, I would say, vulnerable, needy, insecure little child inside who at a very early age learned that there's another way of doing life in the world. I can do life as a bully. I can put on this thick armor and I don't have to feel the pain that I felt when I was traumatized as a second or third grader.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the time you're 35 years old, it's just your identity.
Yeah.
And so if I sit down with a 35-year-old pastor who's narcissistic and I say, you're narcissistic, no, I'm just a confident leader. You know, I'm just a gifted communicator. There's not that level of self-awareness. Yeah.
So there can be like this over-identification with this mask that you, originally you, you know, you had to maybe to survive, you know, just a way of avoiding pain and, you know, trying to cope in the world. But like the technical diagnosis is basically somebody who has taken that mask and then they've associated that as their identity and they've become maybe unaware of the vulnerable child within,
Just who they are,
right?
You know, and we talk about narcissism on a spectrum, by the way. So there's a narcissistic style of relating, which might not even be problematic. It might just be someone who shows up more confidently. But then there's narcissistic type, which may or may not be a problem.
Okay.
I often find that people who test on the psychological testing that I do as narcissistic type have at least some self-awareness so that when I bring that data to them, they'll say, you know, I suspected that I might show up like spiked on that spectrum. And I hate that I can be as arrogant as I am. When they test into personality disorder and I bring that to them, generally they'll become defensive and reactive.
I
and they'll
see.
Say, well, of course, you're a psychologist and you're going to say that. And you know, and we're off to the races. So,
so to speak. Yes.
Yeah. All right. So, so what struck me as you shared about these two essential type of narcissists, the grandiose narcissist is the one I think that comes to mind for most of us who've encountered this word.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Right. The bombastic sort of no empathy, kind of arrogant leader. But we can talk more about that. But I'm curious. You're using this other
vulnerable narcissist.
Yeah, the vulnerable narcissist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could you unpack that a bit and say more about that?
Yeah. Well, some of the features of vulnerable narcissism, I'd say a smug superiority, there's a sense of almost like a condescending. They can be quiet, but there's a quiet condescension when you encounter them. They tend to be self-absorbed. They tend to lack empathy. You'll experience them as passive aggressive. So maybe not the aggressive bullying type that you see with grandiosity.
Yeah.
Emotionally sensitive, you know, there's an emotional reactivity. And so at one moment, they might be pretty put together. And the next moment, maybe you challenge them. How dare you challenge my leadership? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so they tend to be a little bit more emotionally volatile. Mm. And then my experience is they tend to feel misunderstood. Like you just don't recognize how special I am.
Mm.
What a gifted leader I am. Whatever it is,
that identity,
however that shows up for them, yeah. You know. So it's not. It may not be the person on stage. It might be, for instance, I'm thinking of a particular story here. I won't use names, but a rural pastor in a small parish who was a part of a kind of a small church, and it was the true church, you know, with the right doctrine.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was a kind of quiet, shy character, you know, that kind of meekly get up behind the pulpit, and then you'd kind of see the condescending, authoritative word come forth, you know. And when he had a problem with you, he would never come to you directly. It would always be through the back door. It would always be passive aggressive. And people would say to me, I feel like I walk on eggshells around him. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, give me an example of what that looks like. And they'd be like, I'm not really sure. It's just, he's just kind of condescending. And what kind of words does he, I don't even know the words he uses. It's just as he just shows up as kind of a bully, but he doesn't use bullying words. And so it's more confusing.
Yes.
And this is where we get into the language of like emotional abuse, psychological abuse, gaslighting kinds of behaviors, yeah. Things like that, right?
Yeah, so this is fact. Like, we're just developing language, I think, culturally, socially. Yeah. Psychologists had language probably for this longer, but I feel like popularly,
mm-hmm.
people are waking up to the fact as they relate to that person in that local church.
Yeah.
Hey, this isn't right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah. More people know what gaslighting is.
Maybe
now,
30 years ago, though, yeah, it wasn't that this isn't right. It was, how do we keep this guy happy?
Yeah.
And how do we sort of avoid arousing his condescension and ire? And now it's like, wait, you can't, this isn't good.
Yeah. That's right.
This isn't a good deal.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's not good. And what's hard is that if you're in the immediate orbit, you feel it. You know, if you're a staff member, maybe you experience it. But then elders or deacons or other people sort of peripheral to it will say, but he's so good.
Uh-huh.
And he's such a great preacher. And, the book that he wrote was so helpful. And the fruits of what we're doing in our ministry are, you know, God's just blessing what we're doing. So it must be you. You're just sensitive, you know. And that's the crazy-making piece of it.
Yes.
That's when we use the word gaslighting.
Yes.
So, okay, that really helps me. I don't really want to talk about the vulnerable narcissist anymore. Because there may or may not be things that fit that I need to reckon with. But we'll get back to that.
Well,
can we connect this then back to the Enneagram? How do these two sort of big buckets of grandiose and vulnerable, how do they fit into the Enneagram?
So the way I like to think about it, and I didn't go into this in great depth in the book, but I'll give you some like kind of backstory categories that I use. Sometimes folks who talk about the Enneagram use what they call the Hornavian types of the Enneagram.
Okay.
Psychologist Karen Horney, who talked about three sort of primary styles of relating in the world, a more sort of aggressive style, a more ingratiating style, and a more withdrawing kind of style. And there are some scholars in the Enneagram who have said that threes, sevens, and eights are the more aggressive style.
Okay.
I think they show up a little bit more like the grandiose narcissist.
Okay.
We can talk more about that. Nines, four, and fives, which you might assume would be more withdrawing types. Mm-hmm. And they'll show up a bit more like the vulnerable narcissism that we just talked about. And then one, twos, and sixes, who tend to be more the compliant or ingratiating types. And I think it's pretty mixed with them.
Okay.
And even depending on subtypes, which I don't get into in the book, you can see significant differences.
Yeah.
What I did in the book was I tried to just give general summaries of the nine faces, and then I did an appendix at the end with, like, how do you work with folks like this? How do you see growth, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really helpful. So maybe we can go through the nine types.
Sure.
So we've got grandiose and vulnerable, mm-hmm. and they end up splitting out into these overall types. There may be some people listening to the podcast who, like, the Enneagram is very new as well. So maybe as we describe how narcissism shows up in these types, we can just give a brief description of what, you know, what a one is and what a two is and that kind of thing. Yeah. And then I like the idea of maybe ending with, like, how to... I mean, Matt, you're already talking about, like, ooh, like, maybe some... You can recognize this stuff in yourself.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think that's an important thing to point out, though. Mm-hmm. Like, narcissists, it's not just, like, alert, other people might be narcissists.
That's right.
Right? It's alert, we've all got this going on in some level. And so, like, let's learn to be aware of it.
It's not like an on-off switch or binary, like, you got it or you don't. You got the disease or you don't. You know, I do think... when I did my personality testing, my psychopathology testing, I was like, oh, yep, there it is.
Yep.
It wasn't narcissism. It was more histrionic, which is in the cluster B personality disorders, which is like a close cousin of narcissism.
Okay.
But very, like, very much like shows up through fourness and stuff. Yeah. I was like, oh, yep, there it is. Okay.
Yeah, good.
I got work to do.
Yes.
I've always, can I confess something before you get into these?
Yeah.
Sure. I've always thought of histrionic as sort of a badge of honor.
Of course you do. Like, tell us more about that.
You know, I'm just like, you know, not everybody can bring out of their storehouse old emotions and new emotions whenever they want.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's so, you know, I may just be confessing that to you.
Yeah, well, you're forgiven, my son.
Thanks.
Anyway.
All right.
Let's talk about the types. Let's start with one.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe we'll just go through the Hornavian thing.
Good,
you know,
with
more aggressive, grandiose. So, perfect. You know, when we talk about the Hornavian types, the more aggressive types are the threes, the sevens,
seven,
and the eights, right? The threes, some folks call them the winner, the performer. They show up as more grandiose. This is the guy who likes to be on stage. You know, this is when I'm doing my psychological assessments, this is the church planter who's the gifted communicator. Yeah. And, you know, the presbytery or the network has sent them to me. Like, this is our guy. Mm. I mean, he's going to do great things for the kingdom.
Right.
And he's such a gifted preacher. And he's inspiring.
Yeah.
And then we do the testing, and we do a little bit of discernment around personality, and we land on three. Loves to be on stage. Well, that can be healthy, right? Sure. There can be sort of a healthy confidence, and people are gifted in those kinds of ways. But the way I see it show up narcissistically is like he's got to be on stage.
Right.
Like he preaches 52 weeks a year, you know, and I start talking about, well, do you ever allow the associate to preach or – well, you know, he's just we've got to just really protect the pulpit. You know, it's Sunday mornings, or you guys have heard this, right?
Yeah,
Sunday mornings
are
really special times. You know, we can't people are coming in and evaluating us every Sunday. Mm-hmm. He cannot separate his own sense of identity from his stage presence. You know, and so this can be really damaging and destructive, right? I often say to folks like this who are always on stage, like, won't you just allow me to go backstage with you for just a little bit? I just love to know what's backstage, you know, because you're always, even in our counseling sessions or spiritual direction stuff, like he's always on.
She's always killing it too.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is what threes are really good at. They're really good at assessing what is the evaluative measure in which I can have success and be seen as competent, and then I'm going to do that.
Yep.
Yeah. In order to receive, I've heard, like, admiration. Mm-hmm. Admiration is a big deal for threes.
Yeah, and they're chameleons, right? So they can smell out a room and know how to get it wherever they are, you know. And doing the work with threes is really, in a sense, inviting them to backstage. Like, would you let me in for, you know, you can do your little dance for me for, you know, 45 minutes of our session together, but would you just let me, what's it like when you're scared? You know, what's it like when you feel insecure? What's it like when a sermon... you know, go south and you just don't feel like it went very well. You know, and that's where you get them in a place where if they're willing to go there, it can be really beautiful. Yeah. A lot of them are not willing to go there.
Yes.
So threes are most out of touch with their emotions, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sevens, on the other hand, Claudio Naranjo, if you know about the sort of the history of the Enneagram, saw the seven as the classic narcissist.
Oh.
And sevens are often called the epicure, the optimist. But I call these folks the disconnected visionaries. There's always a new thing, You know, like, yep. I've got a big announcement to make, you know, and they come into the staff. We're going to go in this direction for the kingdom, you know, and I need you and you to do this, this, and this. And like a month later, I just got some new inspiration. We're going to do this for the kingdom this time. You know, we're going to build this building. We're going to hire this person. Mm. And they're always sort of living in some sort of future reality, right? But there's this sense of brooding anger, right? Because they disintegrate to one. So there's always this sense of like brooding anger. Like, if you're not willing to go with me, you are against me at some level.
Yes.
Right? So that's how I see them showing up.
Okay. Yeah.
Does that resonate?
It does resonate. I'm giving Matt knowing looks over here.
Yeah. I can't tell if you're hungry, if you have to use a restroom. Yeah, I think what we're doing is we're I think probably both those things are true, but we're also just, it's really difficult to not... think of people when you name these types, right?
Sure.
And they kind of orbit into like your head, and you think about how you relate to them. And I find myself just I'm a four, and I find myself as a four having this confrontational, appositional energy towards threes. So I'm with a three, and they're like got a hand behind their back, and they're doing a show.
Yeah,
I just am like, not today, son. Like, that's my energy. It's
not
like
today, Satan.
You know, I'm not going to. So my average and unhealthy threes want you to mirror their personality.
Mm-hmm.
They want they really want you to like get into their relational space with them. Uh-huh. And I find like I just am like, nope. Yeah. And then they're like, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Why are you mad at me?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But then sevens, man, healthy sevens give me so much life.
Yeah.
Because I tend to be sort of a sanguine, kind of melancholic person.
Yeah.
And when I'm around a healthy seven, it just fills me up with, I don't know, it's like sunshine and rainbows.
Maybe life is going to be okay.
And my seven-year-old, I think, is a seven. She doesn't have tons and tons of wounding and baggage yet. So her unhealth and her seven is not as, as damaging as an adult's unhealth.
Yeah. Right. But she steals gum. Because she wants to make sure she has.
She hoards and steals gum, but her incessant changing of clothes and writing a book every day and drawing pictures and pretending to be teaching a school and all of it, like, and then her singing of songs, like, it actually is such a gift to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Such a gift to me. So I'm thinking about these things as you're talking.
Well, it's beautiful. And you know, we're starting out with a more classic sort of Enneagram narcissists, right? The threes and the sevens. And when I think about a seven, I want them to enjoy the present moment, to sort of drop down into the present moment, drop down into their feelings. They're so envisioned. They're so in their head. They're so in the future.
The next thing is going to be great.
That's right.
Better than now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I'm doing this kind of consulting work and I've got a pastor who is narcissistic and is seven, it's like, it's so hard for them. Like, come on, just tell me where we're going with this. Tell me, is this going to cost me my job? Tell me, we're going to be, you know, and I'm just like, just trust the process. Why? No. Because they can tend to be schemers too, right? Yeah, so there's got to be some angle. So three sevens and then eights, of course. Eights are maybe, you know, the challenger. They can be controlling, threatening. They show up as bullies. I mean, I've got a really good friend who's an eight. I sometimes think eights get a bad rap, you know, it's easy to pin on them the kind of that angry, controlling kind of vibe. But I think eights can show up in really beautiful ways when they get in touch with their own sense of vulnerability, right? Because eights show up. Eights, generally the story is, at a very early age, I learned that vulnerability was not good, not safe.
Not safe,
And so now I've got to operate my world with lots of strength and self-protection. And when you can get to that place where, I told a friend like 12 years ago when we first met, he's like, I don't feel shame. And I'm like, I will find it.
We will get there.
Yes, because I live in shame as a four, right? So, like, I will,
I'm sure
we will find it at some point.
That's great.
And now he, tears come so freely, and he experiences sadness, he experiences his shame. So, so threes, sevens, and eights tend to be the more aggressive types, right?
Yeah.
That we would say would be maybe more typically narcissistic in terms of the caricatures and definitions we have.
Yeah, yeah. So the cultural caricature of a narcissist, right? Three, seven, and eight, that's kind of who comes to mind.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway,
yeah,
lots we could say, but let's move on.
Lots we could say. Well, and we can return back to one of these if we've got time, but let's just flip the script down, go to the more vulnerable withdrawn types, the nines, the fours, and the fives, and you say, a nine?
Mm.
Like, how in the world can a nine show up? But there's a kind of quiet rage in unhealthy nines. Now, we're talking about unhealthy nines. I don't know if you guys remember Riso, was it Riso and Hudson did the levels of development in the Enneagram, right? When he gets down to the lowest levels, right, it's like it's like it gets really dark.
It
does. With nines, even with our nines. Peacemaking friend nines, you know, I talk about the quiet rage. Suzanne Stabile talks about store up arrows in their quiver, you know, just ready to release them at
like
any moment.
Arrows.
Yeah, resentment arrows. Like it's not going to come out like an eight, right? But it's in there. And you might not experience it. You might not feel it, but you got to know it's in there. But it will come out at some point. Mm-hmm. And generally it comes out passive aggressively. It can come out in them just cutting you off when they're really unhealthy or shutting you out.
Yeah.
And so it's like, where did that come from? Because she's so nice.
Never
you
saw
know?
That. Yeah.
Never
yeah.
saw that coming.
Yes.
And so they need to learn to connect to their anger more and own it.
Yes.
You know, like eights need to move toward vulnerability and own the shame. Nines actually need to learn to own their anger. I'm really angry right now. That's an emotion that I feel, and I can say that I'm really angry at you right now. That that's a really beautiful thing with them.
Yeah.
Fours are, of course, we know, Matt, are most like Jesus.
We can skip fours if we want.
Yeah.
So four is the need, just in general, for the Enneagram. For folks, if it's new to you, right? The four is the, Rohr calls it the need to be special.
The need to be special. The individualist, the romantic.
Yeah, the individualist, the romantic.
Yeah. Special is a strategy, though. It's not a core need. It's a strategy.
Yeah.
In order to be seen.
I think a four needs to be seen.
That's right. I'm with you on that.
See me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you
see my authentic self.
And when you see me, if you are able to see me, I'll have a me.
Yeah.
That's the promise.
Yeah.
I'll have an identity if you can see me.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so then special is the hustle to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Right?
Yep.
And so in that sense, at our worst, we can be emotionally manipulative.
Hmm.
We can sort of use our pain, we can use our suffering. And we're not really owning our feelings or feeling our feelings in any kind of genuine way. Now it becomes a way of drawing people into our orbit. You know, I'm always in need. I'm always in crisis. I'm always suffering. Look at me. You're missing me. You're misunderstanding me.
Yeah.
You're neglecting me. You're excluding me. And so we become a bit more vulnerable in our narcissism.
Yeah. And I think it's really clear to me then how like a four can be narcissist, because if your fixation is on a me that you don't think exists, then you're everything's self-referential. Unto that, right?
That's so
that everything you're doing, every moving out in the world is to confirm the me that you're scared to death doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Mm. And, we know from Riso, if it was Riso Hudson who did the levels of development, we can become really self-destructive and sabotaging when we're in unhealth.
Yeah.
But thanks be to God, we're in incredible health, Matt.
I mean,
thank goodness I'm in a room with two healthy fours.
Thank goodness this isn't describing us.
This is the
point. So let's move on then. Yeah.
I thank God that I don't struggle with
smug like
superiority.
Yes,
at
that's
all.
Right. Yes, and I'm never manipulative. Yeah.
Oh,
right. Next interview is with my daughters and my wife to talk about these things. The five, I call the distancer. The five is the observer. The five, the five with narcissism is the intellectually distant one, the condescending one. That's how I see them. The know-it-all. You know, they show up to your community group at church with 17 commentaries, you know, and they're just a participant in the group to show you what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so that smug superiority plays itself out. They generally don't want to be on stage, but boy, do they have power. And they will use their intellectual firepower to destroy you, to overwhelm you.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So, but again, they're vulnerable. Every one of these, they're vulnerable too. Like, but in this sense, I think with, not to get too weird or psychoanalytical or anything like that, but I think that there are little boys and little girls in each and every one of us,
They're
like little 5, 6, 7-year-old, like there's little Chucky inside here who just wants to be seen. I just wants to belong. Just wants you guys to like me. Wants to belong to this crew. So with each one of these, it's like there's a five who, you know, was in his closet at 10 years old reading Tolkien, you know,
memorizing
because the world,
the poems,
memorizing, you know, learning the elven language. Yeah. And, you know, and I'm like, invite me into the closet. I just want to know you.
Yeah.
I want to know the you who was scared to go out into the world and who avoided and isolated. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Beautiful.
That's really good. So, those are the withdrawn types. So
yeah, that's right.
And then the rest of them are, you said, kind of mixed. It's like a mixture of vulnerability.
Mixed. Yeah, ones, twos, and sixes. I mean, ones we sometimes call the reformer, the perfectionist, you know. Mm. And the narcissism that I see here is through perfecting others, perfecting the world,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
There's always a sense that there's something wrong.
There's something wrong, and it's up to me to fix it.
It's up to you to fix it, you know. Yeah. And so you walk around eggshells around them sometimes because they tend to be self-righteous, and there is a smugness. So this could be the smug superiority of the vulnerable narcissist, or this can also be the grandiosity of imagine like the lawyer, the high-powered lawyer who comes in. Yeah.
Chuck, I have a friend. Let's call him Lynn Blurky. And Lynn Blurky, he's a one.
He may or may not be in the room.
So Ben's a one, and you can speak to this a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I chimed in right away because I'm very familiar with that feeling that like there's something wrong with the world, but then like that's true. You know what I mean? Like that's true. Yeah. But then there is sort of automatically for me attached to it a sense of responsibility, which I haven't been often aware of. With that sense of responsibility is also a self-righteousness,
right?
Which is like, well, I know what to do, and it's up to me.
Yeah.
And if you all just listen to me, you know what I mean? Like then things will be better.
And
so my wife has talked about walking on eggshells, you know, and I'm not. It always surprised me when she would say that because I would be like, I'm not aware that I'm projecting some sort of like expectation on you, but I am. I have to be really aware of it that like people tend to encounter me as somebody who's got an opinion and I'm not sure I'm living up to it.
Yeah. Megaphone, you know what I mean? And a whip.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, if the people who are in relationship with you are not connected to themselves and self-aware, they might second guess themselves. I always feel like I'm wrong around him. I always feel like I'm doing something wrong. So yeah, and this plays out. You know, I think the one-to-one or sexual one is the countertype, right? And so it's the more angry,
overtly angry.
Yeah. And I've seen folks like this show up in narcissistic ways, like I'm just a one. I'm entitled to be angry, and you're wrong. You know, that kind of thing. Whereas the social tends to be a little bit more of the smug, condescending one.
Yeah,
you know, constantly living as the archetype of the perfect one. You know.
Yeah.
So one's twos. Two's really interesting. You know, I was doing a podcast with Michael Cusick out at Restoring the Soul, and Michael gave me some insight. He's a two, and he calls twos the benevolent narcissist. You know, Beatrice Chestnut, who writes on narcissism, says that there's this core strategy of seductiveness in the world, manipulation. And they can be really inspiring. They can be really endearing people. They can show up in ways that you just feel like they are for you, but they're doing it in a way to get their own needs met, right? And so I call this like a kind of bless your heart kindness. Bless your heart.
And yet,
so...
So
there's a kind of manipulation that you see in the benevolent narcissist. Like they can't be narcissistic because they're so self-giving. They seem empathetic.
So other-centered. So self-sacrificial.
Right.
Yeah. I feel like an Enneagram 2, like an average to unhealthy Enneagram 2, is 95% of the churches just want their pastor to be that. Idealized pastor for most like Christians is just give me somebody who will always put my needs first and will kill themselves to meet my needs.
Yeah, that's right. And there's that quiet rage in the two also again.
Yeah.
You know, that secret, that quiet resentment, like that you never look out for me.
Yeah.
You know, but...
The hidden contract that they're trying to make with you, which is, I'm going to meet your needs, and you should know that that means you're supposed to meet mine without me having to ask.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Chuck, we've got a dear sister who is an Enneagram 2 that helps support our work at our church. And a few weeks back, there was this little video from Halloween that made the rounds of this kid who came to one of those bowls that people leave on their front porch when they're going to be out of town or not home. And they just say, you know, take a piece of candy. And he gets there and the bowl's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid reaches into his bag and puts candy into the bowl.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I share this with her.
And I was like, it looks like something an Enneagram 2 would do. Yeah. And she says back, she's like, oh my gosh, this kid, this is so Enneagram 2. She said, this kid will have to work all this out in counseling later in life. So it was interesting. Like all these people.
Because his video went viral too, right? Yeah, so it's like his strategy is right there for all the world to see. Yeah.
Well, it also shows us, I think, one of the powerful, part of the wisdom of the Enneagram is that it's not black and white, bad, good.
Right.
Yeah. Right. People look at that kid and they think, oh, what a selfless, giving, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it could be altruistic that's driving him, or it could be this desperate need to be helpful,
to do
something for some other people.
Yeah.
Right?
And like a combination of both in the same act.
Or,
you know what I mean?
Both,
like it could
right?
just be like both, you know, a sense of, well, this is, I'm going to give to some other kids and because this is how I'm going to get my identity. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
And when you're self-aware, that's when we see really glorious things happen in relationship. Like, so when I'm brooding and kind of in my self-prez for long-suffering self, you know, and it was just a really hard day, Sarah, which is just me trying to just, you know, get something from her. Like, just come on, see me right now, right? Mm-hmm. And if I can just stop and say, there you go, Chuck. Mm-hmm. There you go. So why don't you just ask Sarah if she's got time to talk and be honest about what you're feeling rather than employing your strategy of this kind of, oh, yeah, it was another long day. We like to sigh a lot as fours. Like, it was another really long day. I'm so tired. You know, there's so much going on. You know, why don't I just say, Sarah, do you have time to talk? I'm struggling with some things today. And just be honest about what's going on.
Just
you
own
know?
It.
Yeah, just own it. Mm. Yeah. Right?
Brooding. So, brooding is such a powerfully poignant word for that.
Yeah.
Emotional constellation.
Brooding. Yes. Brooding. Oh, yeah. Let's get away from the fours again. And
how do we get back on the
move
fours?
Move to the sixes. Oh, the sixes. Because sixes will rarely show up grandiose, rarely show up on stage. They're behind the scenes. They love to be, you know, loyal to the team, to the institution, to the... But they can use that in ways, and I call them the Hawkeye. They tend to be what I call the hyper-vigilant narcissist, you know, always sort of guarding what's right, guarding the rules of the system. That's not the way we do this around here, you know. And so when I've been around unhealthy sixes, I feel really anxious around them. They're kind of the rule-following judger of others, right? And so you're like, what? She's our accountant. You know, she's quiet. Mm-hmm. She kind of keeps to herself. But how come I, you know, every time I bring a receipt to her and I haven't like gotten, I don't have the itemized receipt. Like she's, like I feel like she's going to jump all over me. But then it comes out like behind the scenes that then my boss comes to me and says, well, so-and-so says that you're not doing this right. And, you know, I always feel like I'm in trouble with her. But she's so nice. She's our nice accountant, you know, and she dresses so well and she's so loyal. And so it's that kind of thing.
Okay.
It's the hyper-vigilant narcissism that you encounter. And they're not really aware of that. And they think they're just kind of like guarding the you know, the rules of the system.
Right.
But they're not really aware of how they're coming off, you know.
Yeah.
A little look-alike stuff to the one with sixes and ones.
Yeah,
I'm hearing that.
Look-alike-y. So, those are the I mean, we're just scraping the surface right now, right?
That's
but those
really
are some
good.
Of the kind of the brief descriptions.
That's really good. What I like about this too is that I think in a cultural moment like now, like we can all sort of look at high profile people like a Steve Jobs or you know, one of the disgraced megachurch pastors in the last 4 years, and they all kind of have the same characteristics, personalities, and we can say, this is what narcissism is, and this is how it hurts people. And what I like about what you're doing, Chuck, is that it's the word narcissism, the awareness of narcissism, can't become a weapon we use on others.
That's right.
Right.
It has to be sort of a microscope or maybe like just a lens that reveals who we are, so that we can stand in solidarity with, you know, that mega church pastor that broke a bunch of people's hearts and left, and we can say, you know, we all have this brokenness, and it manifests itself in different ways. And this is just vital work.
Yeah.
And I appreciate what you've said about some of the types, Chuck, which is, again, like the point of this isn't to be like, ah, that person's a narcissist, cut them off, you know, scapegoat them, you know, now they're a pariah. But for each of these types, you've had a strategy that you've used maybe in therapy or that kind of thing, but a way to sort of invite them into something that would help them move against their narcissism.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? To into true vulnerability, which I think that's been really helpful for me as well.
And knowing the strategies, if you can build some trust and if you can hold it and honor it, not try to beat through the armor that is the kind of the narcissistic self or but knowing the strategy, then you can sort of ask for an invitation to like behind the scenes. Like when I talk about force, sometimes I use the metaphor of a hurricane. You know, the hurricane winds. And so will you invite me to the quiet, calm center of the storm? I'd like to really know you when you're not sort of in draw. Like sometimes when I'm seeing my four clients or spiritual directees, they'll come in, oh, I've got a story to tell you this week. You wouldn't believe, you know? Okay, so I'll let them do their little drama thing for the first 15 minutes. And I'll say, can we just hit pause? Like, would you mind just kind of inviting me behind the scenes into that quiet, you know? And so I want for each one of them, I want to sort of recognize that I see you and this isn't all of who you are. You know, these are strategies that, you know, when you were 6 years old, you didn't wake up one morning and say, I just want to become a asshole, if I can say that on the podcast.
Six-year-olds may not be thinking that, but yes.
But you wake up one day and you're 40 and you're the pastor of a church and suddenly, you know, I'm coming in as a psychological assessor and you're being accused of being a narcissist and now you're really defensive, you know, and I want to say, no, you're an image bearer. You've got a story.
Yes.
You're a person to be known.
Yes.
Now, I want to take seriously how you've hurt people and the ways that this has played itself out. But I also want to take seriously that you're a person in pain as well.
Yeah.
And there's hope.
Yes. It strikes me that that is a way of taking the image of God seriously, is like taking seriously the hurt that I've caused, right? That is taking seriously that you are an image bearer.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful. Yeah. It's one of the things the Enneagram has helped me so much with is just compassion for where other people are coming from and realizing just that, like, they're not trying to be mean, most of them. You know what I mean? Like most people don't set out to be like, I want to hurt as many people as I can today.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Most people are, it's just the unfortunate, inevitable result of me playing this game and trying to get my own needs met. And it's like, well, I guess I hurt somebody again, but...
Yeah.
Until you can name it, and I it's been so helpful for me to realize, okay, there is a vulnerable image bearer in there.
That's right.
Who's hurting, who's trying to just make it through the day, and this is their strategy for doing so. And so maybe I can, you know, be non-anxious enough in this interaction just to ask a few questions and see if they'll come with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to hold both realities, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we often lean on one or the other. You know, like I think we let some narcissists off the hook because it's, you know, the gospel tells us to forgive, you know, and we need to offer grace. And but no, they're hurting people, and there's a debris field, and we need to take seriously the pain that has been caused. I think on the other side, like there was someone who cut me off because she's like, you are too kind to narcissists, and you need to understand that the Bible calls them wicked.
Oh.
And they're the righteous and there are the unrighteous. And you're like a really kind of binary worldview, you know, the ins and the outs, the wicked and the saints, you know.
Yeah.
And you're not being tough enough on narcissists. And I'm like, oh gosh, I guess we disagree because theologically I can't land there. You know? Yeah.
Well, speaking as a narcissist.
But a special one.
A special one. Yeah.
Unlike
the other narcissists we've been describing.
Right.
No, speaking as a narcissist, what does it mean to be tough on them? Well, there's nothing tougher than confronting them with their narcissism and asking them to meet Jesus right there.
Right.
So we have this notion of justice as retributive or punitive rather than restorative,
right?
Making rectification for the wrong that's done.
Right.
And so then if narcissism is this cancer, then the toughest thing you can do is bring that cancer to the surgeon and allow the surgery to happen.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know,
that's right.
Rather than throwing the cancer patient into prison.
Into prison.
Yeah.
That's
punishing
not tougher,
them for having cancer.
Yeah.
So part of it is, how do we get tough on narcissism?
Yeah.
Right? And one of the things I hear you doing, Chuck, and I'm sure it's intentional, is you take the hustle, whatever mask is being worn, and then you do two things. There's an invitation into getting behind that mask that is full of good news, meaning the good news for your being scared of being weak, Enneagram 8, is that you can be vulnerable with me.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's full of an implicit, and there's an actual, like, embodied response that isn't just like, okay, I'm going to assent to what Chuck said, mm-hmm. and that's going to fix my narcissism. No, there's like a relational space you open up for people to step into it.
That's right.
And in view of the mercy that you're speaking, they offer their body as a living sacrifice.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I say that is because I think oftentimes when we talk about things like the Enneagram, which are powerful tools, there's a delta or gap between, okay, what does justification by faith have to do with an Enneagram 4 getting mm-hmm. healthy? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or what does sanctification have to do with...
They think it's a distraction from the gospel or something like
or
that,
or the connection isn't explicit or intuitive for most of us.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, what I hear you doing is gospeling people,
yes.
using the language of the Enneagram and mm-hmm. the lenses it provides to make Jesus as Lord tangible mm-hmm. and granular and concrete as much as possible right where people are.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
It is good. I just I'm affirming that.
I'm doing some really good things.
Chuck, feel good about yourself.
Yeah.
Brood no more, my brother.
So unique and special.
Make sure you tell your wife about
that. Yeah. I said to this mm-hmm. reminds me of a conversation I had with a pastor who I was working with who I said, "Can we make a deal? Mm. Can I use the language of narcissism with you?" Recognizing that there are some narcissistic characteristics and there's been some pain in the church. But can the deal be that I'm not going to define you to your core as a narcissist? And that was really freeing for him. Like because he felt like, oh, if I accept that label, I'm done. And, you know, I have no future in ministry. I've got a condition. But I like the language of cancer or like a disease. It's not the thing that defines you. I think this is the case sometimes with addiction too, and 12-step programs where people define themselves so much as an addict that they forget that there's goodness and beauty in them, that they're image bearers, and that's not the whole story.
Yep. Yes.
Yep.
So
I think that there's a lot of good news. I have a lot of hope. I think that there's I think if this conversation becomes one that is more alive in the church, and we can accept this as a way of just naming, as the Enneagram does, patterns or strategies for getting mm-hmm. our needs met, open-handedly and with a sense of trust, I think there's some room for transformation and hope in the church for narcissistic pastors and
Amen.
Leaders.
That's great.
We need it.
Love it. We
Chuck,
need it.
The name of the book again is
When Narcissism Comes to Church.
Great.
And it's coming out in March.
It's coming
March
out in March.
2020.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can people pre-order yet?
Pre-order, Amazon, IBP.
Okay.
We'll Rich Mal wrote the foreword, which I was really grateful for.
That's great.
And so it's gotten, as people have read it, I've gotten some really good feedback. So I'm grateful for that. I hope it's helpful.
Good. Mm. All right. Yeah. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes if you guys want to pre-order the book.
Thanks for making space.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to my office.
Yeah. It's nice to be
here. Glad you're here.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Chuck.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you enjoy learning from this podcast, please be sure to show your support by rating, reviewing, and subscribing on iTunes. Be sure to share with your friends on social media too. And we would love to hear from you, so please email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. You can join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.